I've started this section on 1 Kings 8 and 9 with ominous signs. In chapter 5, we find out that there is a levy, that is taxation, there's forced labor. I find that I have to say this when I'm addressing the sophomores as we're reading a letter from a Birmingham jail, and we, you know, slavery will come up as an issue in the legacy of slavery. The difficulty is, as an American, slavery for you is always thought of in an American context, and so you always think of slavery as racial, whereas slavery has existed in all societies all over the planet for all of human history. There isn't something really remarkable about slavery. What's remarkable is that it ever stopped. That's what's remarkable about slavery, was that it ever stopped. And so that you, whenever you in the ancient world see like big monumental buildings, think a slave. Because chances are that building has been made by force. They didn't go out and like hire people to build the pyramids. You know, a lot of that is compelled labor. So that's a kind of an ominous sign. Oh, that's right. I wanted to talk Samuel. Remember Samuel? When they want a king, it's their motive that's the problem. We want a king to lead us like the nations. Right? They want to be like the Gentiles. They want to be like the others. And that's why Samuel doesn't approve of their request for a king. They're going to get one, but they want to get one for the wrong reasons. Samuel explains to them, you are going to have a king, and he is going to tax you, and he is going to make your daughters serve in his kitchens, and he is going to make your son serve in the army. And we want a king! It doesn't matter what he tells them. But so now you're seeing that come to be. The very thing that years ago Samuel warned them about when they were going to have a king, here it is. You know, kings mean they're going to compel you to service. At the beginning of chapter 7, it's 7 years on the temple, 13 years on the pair of palaces that he builds, one for himself, one for his Egyptian wife. Now, when you read commentaries on it, I think people try to go the route of, if not justifying, not seeing something that's a problem. They want to say it could be that the temple took shorter because the materials were more ready, that there was an enthusiasm about building the temple. That's why it is it took a shorter period of time than the palaces. Palaces look a little bigger. So it's not clear that it's just a kind of a material or spirited labor. Again, especially because as the years go on, it becomes more and more, if you like, about the glory of the kingdom and less about the glory of the Lord. So that those palaces are bigger is I think, a flag. Think earlier to the marriage of to Pharaoh's daughter. Again, commentators will tell you that so long as she didn't bring the worship of her country with her, that wasn't a problem. Yes, but in light of following events, in light of subsequent developments, don't you have to say that the marriage to Pharaoh's daughter was a bad sign? You can't pick up chapter 11, plot spoiler, and not see the way that that foreign wives turned his heart in his old age, and not see a kind of flag when he marries Pharaoh's daughter. I say these things in part. I feel in some ways I'm talking to my 19-year-old self, because when I read this book in my freshman theology class, we read the whole Bible, and when I read Kings, I got all caught up in the beauty and glory of Solomon's reign. And when I got to the chapter where these turned his heart, I was like, no! It was such a bitter disappointment for me. But what that meant was I wasn't paying attention to the narrative signs. The narrator was warning me, and I didn't want to hear it. So those things combined help, I think, frame what happens later. Even if you take them individually on their own and you can find a kind of a justification or a reasonableness nonetheless, in light of what happens, they're warning signs. I just want to close the loop on some things that I said about the cherubim. I always get self-conscious about which ones come first, and then I invert them. It's the seraphim that are at the top, and cherubim. I think I said the cherubim at the top. It's the seraphim. Seraphim are at the top. Seraph implies flame or fire, and they are especially associated with being closer to God by divine love. The cherubim are associated more with knowledge and science. And then the rest of your, you know, the rest of your angelic orders fall down, you know, go down from there. Remember, it's in Isaiah 6:1, chapter 6, the very beginning, where Isaiah has this vision of the Most High on a throne, surrounded by the seraphim. And in the Eucharistic prayers, for example, in the Byzantine Ruthenian Rite and in the Liturgy of St. Basil, they make, with six wings they soar aloft, with two they cover their faces, with two they fly, shouting, singing, crying out, and then that leads into the holy, holy, holy. So it draws you back to that vision in the Eastern Rites. So I have references here to the cherubim. We talked about Genesis 3. That's when they're first mentioned, keeping Adam and Eve, humankind, out of the garden. They come up again in Exodus 20. I didn't write down 25, but it's Exodus 25, I think, is where they're talking about the design of the ark. And remember, they sit on top of the ark, and then there's this, what's called the mercy. So there's this table kind of on their wings that's meant to be a kind of figure for where God is sitting for his throne. Kings chapter 8, that's where we get it in the description of the temple. Remember, we not only have cherubs on the ark, we have cherubs in front, statues of them facing outward toward the holy place, and then they're on the curtains. They're designs of cherubs stitched into the curtains. So they are all over, all over, all over. Finally, Ezekiel 10. That's where you see them again. And this is the Elvis has left the building. This is where the glory of the Lord rises up from the temple and departs. The presence of God leaves the temple. It's a kind of awe-inspiring scene to read. Remember that in the language of chapter 8, in fact, you hear this in the dedication, this is the place for God's name. Okay, this is the place for God's name. It's not that God is sort of locally there. Here's my address. But this is the place that's dedicated to our realization of him. This is, as it were, where not only where we are meeting him, but where, in a way, he is making himself present not only to us, but to the world. So in some way, the world is to know of God through the temple. And at the point where the people are now so lawless and so rebellious and so degraded by idolatry, at a certain point, God just says, I'm done. Okay, and so that's the vision that Ezekiel sees, the vision of the glory of the glory of God leaving the temple. Let's talk a bit about the idea behind the temple. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. A quick question to ask. They talk about the cherubim and stuff. But the pomegranates, they specifically mention pomegranates. Why pomegranates?
I don't have a response on pomegranates. So I will have to look up pomegranates. I don't know why. If only I had looked up pomegranates before I'd come. Go ahead.
Some people talk about the apple that is a pomegranate.
Yeah, remember in Scripture, the fruit is never identified. You're not told it's an apple. That's what we commonly use because, well, that's Europeans thought that way because that's, you know, in England, that's what they got. They got apples.
But and then the commentary talks about the pillars being like in Eden, like the tree of life and the tree of
knowledge. Oh, yeah. Yeah, remember, this was something I talked about last time, that the idea of the Holy of Holies. Again, I refer you to Joshua Berman's excellent book on the temple, that the Holy of Holies is meant to express Eden. Because at the beginning of Genesis, you know, the idea in chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3 before the fall, that Adam and Eve are together with God in this kind of privileged state, and that after sin, they're expelled, and now the cherub act as guards to keep them, you know, to keep them out. So the temple, especially the Holy of Holies, is this attempt to recover this sense of what was had in Eden, that man is meant to that God is meant to walk among men, that he's meant to be present to them, but because of sin, it also expresses the separation. So on the one hand, God is with us, he's dwelling with us, he's in the Holy of Holies, but yet because of sin, we are separated from him. So remember, in the design, the high priest only goes into the Holy of Holies. The priests are in the holy place, and everybody else is out here in the court. Okay? So there are these stages, there are these distinct separations. Go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering, so in the Holy of Holies is going to be the ark, right?
And, correct.
And something that confused me was they said the ark contains only the tablets.
Yeah, that came up, and so that's what I have over here. When St. Thomas, it's in the Summa, he has a discussion of the fittingness of what's in the Holy of Holies and what's in the ark. And he talks about the rod, the manna, and the tablets. And, you know, from the church fathers, some of this goes back to Hebrew commentators, but by the time St. Thomas is talking about this, the rod indicates authority. So it's the rod of Aaron signifying God's authority. There's the manna, which is signifying the way that God nourishes his people. So there's governance, there's food, and then the tablets signify wisdom. Okay? And those three things then are also in some way represented in the holy place. You don't have the tablets, but instead the candles. I was asked about the candles. The light, the illumination. The Lord is my light and my illumination. In some way, that's meant to now express teaching. The showbread is the manna, and the priests are exercising the authority. Okay, so you have this thing that's sort of perfectly expressed in the Holy of Holies, then represented further out, then represented less further out as you go. Okay, for us, this whole thing kind of... there's something exotic about it, but it grates against our customs and sensibilities. You know, why would you have a place that only one person can go into once a year? Because remember, you're conveying the, I hate to use this word, but there's no better one, the awesomeness. You know, we abuse that so much. Everything is awesome. I got an A on my test. Awesome. Yes. This transcendental supernatural awe descends that you have achieved this grade. But awe is something that it's a kind of fear. It's not the kind of fear that you have, let's say there's a tiger or a rat or something like that. You know what I mean? It's a fear of something that is completely other from your sort of natural or ordinary experience. It's completely other. So the way that Lewis will describe it, if somebody told you there's a tiger in the next room, you'd feel a certain kind of fear. But if somebody told you there was a ghost, you know, even if you didn't believe in ghosts, to be afraid of a ghost would be a different kind of thing than being afraid of a tiger. You're afraid of something otherworldly, something uncanny, would be a way of putting it. Go ahead.
Okay, between Rosh Hashanah, which was just celebrated this last weekend, and Yom Kippur, which will be celebrated this coming, are the days of awe.
Hmm.
And we're in the middle of the days of awe right now, the Jewish community is. This was so perfect. I'm like going, I get to read and exist in the days of awe with this study too. And it is a time of, I was explaining this to my group, of me, you know, let's say I get into a fight with someone, it's my obligation during this time of awe to examine my conscience. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And to really, but not just to go, well, you know, I had a little spat, but it's like, how did I hurt that person?
Really, yeah, you think about the impact.
10 days, you're examining your conscience, and then on Yom Kippur, you take all the sins, like, I'm supposed to go and apologize to my fellow people. No, I'm supposed to apologize to people that I've hurt, people that I lied to, or, you know, I said, you know, I'm going to come over and mow your lawn, but I never did. You know, all those...
Please offend me.
So then...
That lawn is really a nuisance.
And Yom Kippur is the time when I bring all those sins that I have now repaired, because that's why it says, if you offend a brother... Go leave your offerings at the altar, go and repair that relationship, and then bring it to the Lord. And so the days of awe are where you would kind of, I'm going to put it in Christian terms, get down on your hands and knees and beg God to help you remember what you need to repair.
Yeah, good. So I want to continue that thought. At this point, let me bring in this fellow right here. Moses Maimonides, Moses ben Maimon is how you would say it in the Hebrew world. He writes around the year 1000 into about 1100, and he's sometimes described as the Jewish Thomas Aquinas. Now, that's not quite accurate, because to be operating in the Jewish world and with the way that Jewish commentary worked, it's a very, very different kind of thing than it is for St. Thomas. St. Thomas writes a Summa Theologia because he's focused on God. Whereas for Moses ben Maimon, Moses Maimonides, what he's writing about is the law. So you talk about God insofar as he relates to the law, but what you're primarily explaining is the law. Now, the reason he comes up is when you read St. Thomas, and he will talk about the fittingness of Old Testament practice. Like, why did they sacrifice? Why did they sacrifice the animals they sacrificed? Why was the temple arranged the way it was? St. Thomas's go-to person for those things is Moses Maimonides. So that was how I first ran into Moses Maimonides, just from reading St. Thomas. When you get into the sections on the Old Testament, lots and lots of things from Moses ben Maimon, Moses Maimonides. And this is from the sections on the temple are from chapter 45. You can find editions of it online. You know, it's in public domain. But he talks about how it is that when he describes the Holy of Holies and describes the holy place, all this aimed at... So he's talking about the holy place, I guess. All this aimed at producing due respect toward the sanctuary and indirectly the fear of God. When a person enters the temple, certain emotions are produced in him. Obstinate hearts are softened and humbled. These plans and indirect means were designed by the law to soften and humble man's heart at entering the holy place in order that he might entrust himself to the sure guidance of God's commandments. Okay? So there's this idea that you are designing this thing to create an emotional response, of humility, of docility, that you're not walking into a space, in other words, it's somehow like this is your space or something that's sort of comfortable for you. In fact, it's supposed to be actually a little uncomfortable. It is supposed to make you aware of the greatness of God's presence and the smallness of your presence by comparison. So it used to be in the traditional liturgy, in the Roman Rite, when you had the dedication for a church. If you look that up in an old missal, it quotes this line from Genesis. Remember where Jacob has run away and he's sleeping on the hill of the rock, and he has, remember, this vision of angels going up and down this ladder. And he wakes up and he says this very striking thing: how fearful this place is, the house of God, the gate of heaven, and yet I knew it not. And that is the antiphon for the dedication of a church. How fearful this place is. Again, not fearful like teen slasher movie, Fearful, Jason the Axe Murderer, Fearful. Fearful in the sense of this is something otherworldly, right? Think about the words of Jacob, the house of God, the gate of heaven. Here was God, and here was the Lord, and I knew it not. Okay, and so that's what a church, that's what the temple was supposed to effect in people, and that's what a church, in some ways, is supposed to effect in people. Okay, so where are we now? Oh, so remember, the temple is fundamentally about sacrifice. So there's a sacrifice that happens in the Holy of Holies once a year. The regular sacrifices that happen out there in the holy place, and lots of incense. As, again, to quote Moses Maimonides, since many beasts were slaughtered daily in the holy place, the flesh cut in pieces, the entrails, the legs burnt and washed, the smell of the place would undoubtedly have been like the smell of slaughterhouses if nothing had been done to counteract it. They were therefore commanded to burn incense there twice every day, in the morning and the evening, in order to give the place and the garments of those who officiated there a pleasant odor. There is a well-known saying of our sages, in Jericho they could smell the incense. So remember, Jericho is like down a ways. So the idea that this place was so full of incense that you could smell it for miles. Okay, but the alternative was it would have smelled like a slaughterhouse. If you were carrying out sacrifice of animals in the way that they were, and they weren't, you didn't have incense, you know, that would have just been unbearable. Okay, it's the reason why that in a modern church, when you have incense, it isn't there just to like trigger your allergies or annoy you or get you coughing. That is there to remind you that you are at a sacrifice. Okay, that form of ritual worship is connected with what that service or what that form of worship is essentially about. I'll say more about that in a little bit. Maimonides, I had mentioned sacrificing animals. Most of the animals that they were legislated to sacrifice were animals that were either adored or sacred to other peoples around them. So the idea was you were sacrificing animals that the pagans, you know, considered special, and so you're doing things in a way in detestation of idolatry. You are turning your back on kind of these cultures around you and doing it different. So, as again, to quote Maimonides, in order to eradicate these false beliefs, the law commands us to offer sacrifices of only three kinds. You shall bring your cattle, the herd, and the flock. Thus, the very act which is considered by the heathen as the greatest crime is a means of approaching God and obtaining his pardon for our sins. In this manner, evil principles are diseases of the human soul, and they are cured by other principles which are diametrically the opposite. Okay? Think about the orientation of the temple. Remember, this is west. That's why that W is there. This is east over here. You were worshiping facing west. And the reason you were doing that is because all of the heathens faced east. They worshiped the sun. They were... and in fact, I think it's in Ezekiel, where you have the things have gotten so bad that the priests of the temple are, after they do what they're doing here, then they have their backs to the temple and they're facing the sun and offering sacrifice. Go ahead,
so
Bettina.
A lot of Christian churches oriented to face east.
They are. And so that's why down here in diagram two, I have a Christian church, and you'll notice I have the tabernacle and the sanctuary this way. I have the nave, which is equivalent to the court here, and then your sort of outside part there. And you're right, in the Christian church, it's switched around. And the reason it's switched around is because, yes, Christians have become sun worshipers. No, the reason it's switched around is because the expectation that Christ will come from the east at the end of the world when he comes in judgment. He will come in the east. So there's this turnaround. You are at the stage now. By the time you're at the time that Jesus has come, remember, the Hebrew people have idolatry beaten out of them by then. They've got other problems, but they are not idolaters. When they come back from the Babylonian captivity, you do not hear any more about idolatry. The only idolatry that you hear about are when the Greeks invade and they set up idols, and then they kind of use their military might to try to bully people into worshiping things. But of themselves, no, the Hebrew people are not doing that anymore. Go ahead.
Every synagogue, not temple, but every synagogue. Faces toward
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. And so if you're in like Africa, it would face north. So it's almost like our ark is always faced toward the the holy place.
Right. So there's more to say about that, but let me say this other thing first. One of the things Maimonides said, that the first I've seen it is in him, is that this is another reason why it is that the temple is built as late as it is, or why it comes in later stages. That, remember, when Abraham worships, and he worships on Moriah, he worships on this mountain. And remember, there's a whole lot of time between the sacrifice of Abraham and the time of Moses. It's centuries. So where exactly is this? Okay. And the Moses Maimonides will say that Moses, the lawgiver, knew where Abraham worshipped and intended that that's where the temple was going to be. But you can't say that too early, because now the tribes will contend to have the temple in their own place, in their own spot. And if you designate it too early, it's also something that then becomes attractive for the Canaanites and all their enemies around them to seize and take. So that's why you've got to have complete stability before you're able to say, okay, the temple is here. Okay? Because as you know, there isn't talk of where the temple is going to be. If you think back to your Judges and Joshua and Samuel, it isn't clear where it's going to be. In Deuteronomy, you're told, it will be at the place that I name. It will be at the place that I designate. But we're not, where is that? Okay. Let's talk about this business of facing west, facing east. Two church fathers that are very helpful on this. St. Basil, who's an Eastern father, also St. John of Damascus. Let's see. Here's what St. Basil says when he's talking about it. He gives this as an illustration of a tradition, something that's not written down. One form of silence is the obscurity in Scripture which makes the meaning of dogmas difficult to be understood for the very advantage of the reader. Thus, giving an example now of something that's not written down, we all look to the east in our prayers, but few of us know that we are seeking our old country paradise, which God planted in Eden in the east. So like facing Jerusalem, now what you're doing is facing Eden. We pray standing on the first day of the week, but we do not all know the reason. On the day of the resurrection, or standing again, we remind ourselves of the grace given to us by standing at prayer. Okay, so those points in the Mass when you're standing. And by the way, in Eastern liturgies, Eastern Catholic liturgies, there's a lot more standing because of that reason. You're signifying the resurrection. During the Easter, so Eastern liturgies, there's almost no kneeling. And, you know, for us in the West, if there's no kneeling, it's because, like, people kind of want to be comfortable and cushy. Whereas in the East, no, you're standing because you're proclaiming the resurrection. That's why you're standing. St. John Chrysostom, this is the thing I was saying earlier. Since God is the spiritual light, Christ is in the Scriptures the Son of Righteousness and Dayspring, east is the direction that must be assigned his worship. For everything good must be assigned to him from whom all good things arises. As David said, sing, O God, unto God, kingdoms of the earth. Sing praises unto the Lord, that he that writes the heaven of the heavens toward the east. And then he mentions Eden, and God planted a garden eastward in Eden. Okay? Notice the design, if you think about traditional church architecture, so for a Catholic church, and a lot of like old, traditional Anglican churches would look like this. There's the tabernacle. I left out the altar here. Altar would be right by the tabernacle. Oh, there they are. Right, so there's our altar. It's in this area, which is the sanctuary. So the tabernacle is equivalent to the Holy of Holies. The sanctuary is equivalent to the holy place. And then the court, this is where the people, you know, people are. And again, in a traditional church, this would have been said, there was a very clear distinction, because there would have been an altar rail, you know, like so. And it's much more distinct in Eastern Orthodox churches, Eastern Catholic churches, where you have an icon screen, an iconostasis. And so the priests and the deacons are coming out on one side of that icon screen and then going in the middle, and the doors will be open and the doors will be closed, and you are not fully seeing what's happening. You know, when you are out in the congregation, you are not fully seeing what is happening in this sanctuary area. So, in other words, when you look at traditional Catholic worship, Eastern Orthodox worship, it's drawing over these same ideas from temple worship. There is a sacrifice. The priests and the assistants are in the area of sacrifice. The people are out here. The people are not going into the sanctuary. The priests are occasionally coming out, but they just go out to come right back in. You know, they come out to process. And the idea when they're coming out is that somehow they are bringing your prayers or intentions or whatnot with them, but there is a very clear distinction. Okay? And you know, the incense, as I mentioned earlier, again, you are emphasizing that this is a sacrifice. This is a sacrificial ritual. This is if you were to just sort of point to one area that would be the easiest to point to in terms of the break between, let's say, Catholic Eastern Orthodox worship and then the worship that starts under the Reformers, under Calvin and Luther. Here it is, right here. Because the break that Luther makes and then Calvin after him, this is not a sacrifice. We are ministers. We are not priests. So it fundamentally changes what worship is about. Okay, if you think that what you're doing is Christ is the new priest, that when he ordains apostles, he is ordaining priests. He's ordaining essentially bishops who then pass on the priesthood. Then what's happening in Christian worship is a representation of Christ's perfect sacrifice on the cross. And so you aren't going to describe it in terms of, let's say, the Last Supper. You're not to describe it in terms of communion. Those are things that come after. Those are things that are results. What distinguishes the Mass, what its defining trait is that it is a sacrifice. Okay, and everything else that happens in the liturgy fundamentally serves that. Okay? I remember one of our chaplains in my college, when he would talk about vocations, I remember him saying this, that do you feel as though you understand theology well, you relate to other people well, you know, you're good with understanding people's relationships and feelings? Do you think you have a sense of being able to handle people's problems? Do you think that you're good at explaining? You can take something difficult and explain it, okay? If you have all those things and nothing else, you are not called to be a Catholic priest. The Catholic priesthood is not about explaining theology. It's not about helping people with their problems. It's not about, it's not about volunteer. It's not about any of those things. To be called to the Catholic priesthood is to be called to the sacrifice of the altar, and then doing the things that allow people to share in that, like confession and baptism and so on. That's why when you talk to priests, very often they will tell you the first inkling or the first notion or nudge that they got that they were called to the priesthood was when they were serving as altar boys, because that's a defining trait. After the Protestant break, you understand yourself as a minister or a pastor, where basically what you are doing is leading people in prayer. You are instructing them. You are preaching. You are leading people in prayer and song. You will have a communion service, but you understand that what you're doing is, if you believe in real presence, that's something that somehow happens with the congregation together. That is not a ministerial power, right? So as Luther describes, Luther still believes in real presence, remember, and more conservative Lutheran communions believe in real presence. But they don't think that happens by some kind of act of the minister. Okay, that isn't something that happens as a power. That's something that somehow the congregation does together. Okay, and once you get out from there into your more mainline Protestant communions, you aren't even thinking about real presence anymore. In other words, you have communion because it's a kind of a memorial of the Last Supper. Okay? And in Calvinism, that becomes very much emphasized, that a Calvinist service is a kind of memorial of the Last Supper. Sometimes I will ask Catholic teenagers in a parish to find the Mass for me, and they'll say, it's a memorial of the Last Supper. And I'll say, congratulations, you're a Presbyterian, because that's the Presbyterian belief on communion. So, as I said last week, the what you believe is happening, what you believe worship is about, that determines the shape of your building. So if you think that fundamentally what's happening is a sacrifice, then you're going to have an altar. You're not going to call it a table. You're going to call it an altar. And you're going to have a tabernacle. You're going to have a holy place. You're going to do these things because what you think you're doing is sharing in Christ's sacrifice. Okay? If you don't really believe in sacrifices and altars and all that, then you're going to de-emphasize the sanctuary area. It's going to gradually kind of melt away. There are going to be more and more kind of lay people up there. There are going to be lay people maybe even preaching. Maybe you have the choir over here. Maybe it becomes circular. Maybe it becomes hexagonal. In fact, you can have churches now where there isn't really a distinct holy place. There's this sort of raised area. You might trip over it, but it is distinct. And it's the reason is they believe, whoever's in charge, believes something different about what is happening in that ritual than this. Because this flows logically from the temple. And anybody who sees the temple, who's grown up on kind of traditional church architecture, immediately sees where things fit. Okay? In fact, the glorious thing about the church is that no longer is there merely a Holy of Holies in one spot in the Near East, that the miraculous power of Christ and the work of his apostles allow for there to be Holy of Holies, allow for this union of man and God all over the world. Right? But at the point where, in fact, going back to your point about synagogue, in a way, the Protestant Reform has changed the notion of church from a temple to a synagogue. It is more of a place of preaching, song, fellowship. Although even in synagogue, there would at least be this sort of orientation toward the temple or this memory of the temple. Yeah, I have to get this
right. We just had a discussion this morning about churches that had removed, and Catholic churches that removed the tabernacle.
Yep, they have taken the Lord and we know not where they have laid him. But that was because there really was a kind of alternate theology going on. Yeah, there really was this idea that you were getting away from, I'll just say this one last thing, that you have Mass ad orientem, that the priest and the people are all facing the same direction. If this is your pattern, that makes all the sense in the world. The first thing that happened in the Lutheran reform of the liturgy and in the Calvinist reform of the liturgy was that they turned the minister around. That was the very first thing that happened, because he's no longer an intercessor in a rite of sacrifice. He is leading in prayer, song, and instruction. So that's why the minister is facing the people. What, depending on how you move things around, is all about what do you think is happening? What do you think that's about? Well, that's all the time we have, so we can start with you next time, Mr. Davis.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next week, 9 and 10, I have your assignment on the board over there.